Marcy.
Okay. You can read the picture a little fuller. Okay, good evening. It's really a pleasure to have everybody here. And I just want to thank everybody for coming, and it's so wonderful to see the commitment that so many people have coming out in a weeknight. It's always difficult, but the commitment to our children and to Shabbat and putting those two things together and that piece is really wonderful. And it's really my pleasure to welcome back Dr. Polkowitz, who's been here before, and to just give you quickly about his bio. That Dr. Polkowitz holds the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Psychology and Education at Yeshiva University's Azrieli Graduate School, where he also teaches pastoral psychology courses. He also serves as a special assistant to the president of Yeshiva University. And before assuming his position on the faculty at YU, Dr. Polkowitz was a clinical professor of psychology in psychiatry at New York University School of Medicine and director of psychology at North Shore University Hospital, NYU School of Medicine. Dr. Polkowitz has published and lectured extensively in a variety of topics related to the psychological impact of trauma and loss, child and adolescent behavior problems, parenting, and the impact of divorce and stress on children. Most recently, he co-authored a book on parenting with his father, Rabbi Polkowitz, titled Balanced Parenting. That's what's written here. On a personal note, it's really, Dr. Polkowitz has just been a wonderful resource. I know to myself, as an educator, and to a number of the people that I speak with, that he's really somebody who's committed to supporting those of us that are here working in the schools in Jewish education. He's really somebody that I know personally. I can't imagine that he must get hundreds of these phone calls a week, that people are dealing with difficult situations, and he's become our telephone number, and he gives out his cell phone number and says, call me anytime, I'll be available. And he really is. And on a personal note, I really want to thank him, one, for being here again for us, and specifically being such a wonderful resource for us in the school. Dr. Polkowitz.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Haber. And I want to thank the committee for really doing an outstanding job. The series of questions that were outlined tonight are not, they're not normal questions in the sense that, and I mean that in the best kind of way. I just have a professor would say there are two kinds of people. He'd say they're normal people and they're people I know. You know, it's interesting. But this is like actually really, in my conversations with the committee, they came up with really workable questions that we often don't think about. And I want to make four or five core points based on these questions, and I'm going to have it organized what I was asked to speak about today. So the first question is how do we keep our children engaged at the Shabbos table? Okay, obvious question, something to think about, and something that forced me to think. And I can think of nothing more important than at times taking a step back and thinking about our goals. There's some fascinating research in psychology that shows that if I had everybody here spend the next 15 minutes writing down what are your goals for 10 years down the road, where do you want to be 10 years from now? So if you did that, two things would happen. If you did, especially if you did it for 2-3 days in a row, your happiness levels would go up, and it would make it more likely that you'd realize your goals. It's an important thing to do, but we don't do it enough. Especially in today's busy world, we often don't take a step back to think about the really important goals. And these are important goals. This stuff matters. Michael Josephson, who's the head of the Center for Ethics, very respected writer on instilling and imbuing children with ethical values, quotes somebody who says something brilliant. And it's going to sound familiar, but it's the way I wanted to start. He says, here's how you have to live your life. Imagine that after 120 years, you're a fly on the wall at your eulogy. And they're eulogizing you. And you're hearing them say whatever it is they're saying about you. Think now about what do you want them to say about you? What do you want basically your mission statement to be? How do you want to be remembered in terms of your mission statement, in terms of your bumper sticker? distill it down to maybe three or four things that really are the ways you want to be remembered, and live life backwards. Very interesting. Because very often, our kids grow up, and things are kind of happening in a non-examined, unexamined way. And unless we occasionally think that way, and unless we occasionally live life backwards, it's easy to have it kind of get away from us. So the first question has to do with a very basic question. It happens every Shabbos. Every Shabbos, we have our kids come around our Shabbos table, or they go to the children's table in the kitchen, which is something that we're going to talk about. And what makes sense in terms of motivating them in a way that we could get them engaged? Because especially young kids are certainly not going to easily be engaged. It doesn't happen without thinking. So let me start by sharing with you the three C's of the psychology literature on motivation. So the psychology literature on motivation, and there's been a lot of research on how do you motivate a kid. And the three C's are the following. C number one is clarity. Being clear about your goals. Just clarity. Once you get in touch with what's your fantasy about Shabbos? How do you want your Shabbos table to look? How do you want your children one day to remember your Shabbos table? How do you want your grandchildren to remember your Shabbos table? What do you want their kind of vision of your family Shabbos table to be? And communicate it in a deliberate way to your children, not in a way that's nagging, not in a way that they develop parent deafness, nothing like that, but in a way that every once in a while you have a planned discussion with them to calmly discuss with them sort of what you're hoping for, what you're looking for, and it's something you obviously have to model. So to the extent that there's clarity of goals, it makes all the difference in the world. There was a fascinating study I heard about at an education conference last year. It was a study, I forget who funded it, but they were looking at what differentiates kids who go to Hebrew schools, not kids who go to yeshivas or day schools or community schools, but kids who go to Hebrew schools. It turns out if they stay through 12th grade, there's a very low rate of intermarriage. If they drop out after their bar bat mitzvah, there's unfortunately extremely high rate of intermarriage. So it becomes a very worthy goal to try to get kids to stay through 12th grade. So they did an intensive study out of Harvard trying to see what differentiates those Hebrew schools that keep kids in through 12th grade. And it turns out that it was deceptively simple. What it boiled down to is the key predictor was clarity of goals and expectations. When you started that school, when a kid was enrolled in the Hebrew schools that had the highest retention rates, the head of school would sit down with the parents and say, look, by enrolling your kid here, it means that you're committing to bringing your child to this Hebrew school through 12th grade and not to end after Bar Bat Mitzvah. There are other Hebrew schools to go to if you want to end after Bar Bat Mitzvah. My expectations are expectations, and you're giving me your word that you're going to stay here through 12th grade. And then they'd have conversations like that with the kids once they were old enough to understand it. That simple communication of goals, that clarity made all the difference. It says in Mishlei, "Be'ein chazon yifara'am." Without that vision, things, we sort of dwindle away. And that's the first C of motivation. It's just get in touch with what do you want. It matters. I can't tell you what it should be. The answer to all these questions are, you have to look in your heart, you have to look in your soul, you have to figure out, what do you want? What's really important to you? What is it that you love about your Shabbos table growing up? What is it you don't like so much about your Shabbos table growing up? I heard this from a relative, and it's a very powerful, powerful message now that we're heading into the Adar and then Pesach season. And it goes like this. It says, when you're sitting down at a Seder table, as we will not too long from now, so closer than you think, even with two others. When you're sitting down at your Seder table, and let's say you have a set of grandparents on one end, okay, and young grandchildren at the other end. So you have grandparents, let's say, going into their 80s, and then you have the next generation, and the next generation, then you have, let's say, a baby sitting around, which is not unusual for a Seder table. So they say, if you look at the collective memory of that table, so it'd be the memory of an elderly grandfather sitting at a table, will have memories spanning back to people he knew or she knew going back how many years, right? Going back, I mean, I know that my grandfather, for example, my memory, my grandfather, my grandparents would talk about people they knew from the Civil War, or talk about in very vivid ways about the 1800s. And then the baby going forward will one day know people who will go forward into the next century. Okay? So it's a collective memory. It's about 300 years, that kind of collective memory around a Seder table. So the person pointed out, it only takes 10 such tables to go back to Yetzias Mitzrayim. Think about it. It only takes 10 such tables to go back to Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's the power of a Jewish table in terms of collective memory and in terms of the Masorah. I don't know why I shared that. It's just an interesting thing. And everybody's thinking and probably thinking about ways. It didn't make sense, did it? But we'll talk about it later. Okay, I just want to get your attention and have people thinking and maybe challenge me later. Okay, so that's the clarity of goals. Okay? Okay. One more thing in terms of clarity of goals. And it's the power of friends. Okay, so we have friends. I'm sure that many of you on a typical Shabbos has friends come over on a Friday night or Shabbos, depending on the time of year, Shabbos lunch. Most people have at least one meal on Shabbos where you have company or you are company. And the question is, what's the role of children when adults are around? And does it make sense in terms of clarity of goals to put children front and center? And we're going to get to talking about that a little bit later. But also, is it something that should be questioned? As we have to be sure to have enough meals where it's just the children without company. And I'm balancing that against my first story. Okay, it's a brief story, but it's a powerful story for me. I was at a wedding. I worked in a hospital for many years where a pretty non-Jewish place. A very WASPy place, especially when I started there. It was part of the Cornell system. And people who didn't have much exposure to Orthodox Jews. And one of my close friends made a wedding. He was an Orthodox Jew. And it was the first time that any of the psychiatrists and psychologists at the hospital had ever been invited to an Orthodox Jewish wedding. And it's, of course, something that we're all used to, and how many of them do we go to in a given year? And I was assigned to the table of the non-Jewish psychiatrists and psychologists. And we were just sort of like doing our thing. And they saw my community in action, because the psychiatrist who was making the wedding lived in my community, and it was my community. And they saw that a lot of children were invited, and everybody knew everybody else. And my son came over at the time. He had saved up money to buy a clunker of a car that had broken down famously on the Van Wyck Expressway on his way to school. And everybody knew about it, and people are going over to him and talking to him about it. And everybody seemed to know everybody else. And I go back to work that Monday morning, and practically every psychiatrist and psychologist stopped me in the hall. And they said, David, do you know what you have? Do you know what you have in your community? You're probably too close to it to see how wonderful it is. And an Italian psychiatrist stopped me. He said, I go to Italy every summer for a couple of weeks with my kids, just to show my kids what the old Italian folkways were like. He said, I thought that way of life was gone, where everybody knows everybody else, and there's a sense of community and a sense of connection and a sense of caring. He said, you're so lucky. You're living a way of life that is essentially dead for us and for all of our patients. He says, appreciate it. And I heard that all week long at the hospital. And it got me to think. Sometimes you have to see it through the eyes of somebody else. So there's something wonderful about the Shabbos table, something wonderful about our Shabbos guests, although we should invoke in Greinich there's something called the Shimmel rule. The Shimmel rule is that at 3 o'clock Shabbos afternoon, there's a well-known, very confident, wonderful leader in our community who, he doesn't care how many people are there, if he has guests over at 3 o'clock, he says, I have to take a nap. And he gets up and he goes and takes a nap, and that's how he carves out space for himself, and he carves out space for his children. and he models that for everybody in the community. But sometimes it goes on all day long, and it becomes the center of our life, sometimes at the expense of husband-wife time, and sometimes at the expense of parent-child time. So that's clarity. That's the sea of clarity. Figure out what you want, implement it. Okay? Be'en chazon yifara'am. Keep your eye on the ball. When you have that vision, it makes a difference. The second C is the C of communicating with your child to hear what are their expectations. What's their experience of your Shabbos table? Are they happy with it? Are they not happy with it? Would they want it to be different in any way? Anytime you give your child a voice and you hear them out, it's much more likely to make them motivated in the process. So giving a child, communicating your child with your child in a way that gives them a voice, ask them, for example, do you want to be around when we have company the whole meal and sit and listen to us? Or do you want us to front load at the beginning, you're going over your Parsha sheets or whatever it is that you might be doing, or having us have child-focused conversation and then run around with your friends? Do you prefer, give your child a voice every once in a while, how often do you think we should be having company? Do you need to have us, have just us around the table every once in a while? To the extent that we hear our child and give them a voice, and even if it's just the illusion of choice, it still means we're in control, but just making them feel that you really value what they have to say, and even more importantly, as there's conversation around the Shabbos table, hear their perspective. Pull them into the conversation. Seat them in a way that they become part of it. And if you're talking about something that's not for their ears, don't talk about it until they leave. That's very important because the kids' values are very much shaped by what they hear around the Shabbos table. In the longitudinal studies regarding developing empathy in children, one of the fascinating findings is that a key predictor of matchmaking is how we present and honor and respect the perspective of others when we're talking with adults within the earshot of our children. It shapes values. Our children's values are very much shaped by what we talk about with friends around the Shabbos table, or what we even talk about with our spouse around the Shabbos table, or other family members. Realize that. That's what kids really absorb, even much more than direct communication. And give them a voice about their role in all of that. Again, it doesn't mean they're in charge, but it means that we hear them. To be understood, first understand. So the second C is communication with them where we hear them out. Because that's, in all the research, that's a big point in terms of motivation. And the third C is choice, which is very much just a variation on the theme of what I just said. You give them options. So you ask them, would you rather discuss the parsha at the beginning of the meal or at the end of the meal? Would you rather sit down and then go with friends, or do you want to come towards the end of the meal? Whatever, I can't tell you what to do. This is all very much driven by your vision of your Shabbos table and how you want it to be remembered. And how do you want it to be remembered for the generation? Okay? Are you going to sing Zmiros or you're not going to sing Zmiros? Is it important for you to sing Zmiros? What are your fondest memories of your Shabbos table growing up, of your grandparents' Shabbos table growing up? This stuff matters. It may not feel like it matters, but it matters because it's what the Mesorah is all about. And it's what our traditions are all about. And it's the way religion and spirituality is really communicated. So that's part one. Okay, that's in terms of that. We're good on the three C's? Okay. Part two. How can we keep our children interested and feel on Shabbos? So we're going to have a discussion. I'd like to really get a discussion going. And then the next question is the question of tefillah. Most of you have kids who are young. What's very sad in what the research shows is the highly motivated elementary school child, and even highly spiritually motivated bar mitzvah age child, by the time they go off to high school, especially by the time they're 16, things start going south. We've done some very nice research supported by Avichai, a grant called the Ruach Grant, where we've been interviewing kids in different parts of the country in depth to try to understand what their spiritual connections are, what their alienators are, and to try to understand what happens. And it's pretty universal that the spiritual connection that you're seeing now isn't necessarily going to stay there throughout high school. It then comes back. From the research, it's clear that it will come back. But you have to, sometimes it's helpful to know about it. You have to manage your expectations. And when you know about it ahead of time, it's important to understand it. And very much the groundwork you lay now will decide what will happen in high school and what will happen in young adulthood. I want to share with you some of the research on that so you understand it better. And what the adolescents tell us nourish their neshamos and what alienates. So that's what I want to talk about first. Number one is expectations. In your handouts, what you're going to see, even though I'm not so sure we should have put it in, but it's an unbelievable Yerushalmi. And Yerushalmi says the following. Yerushalmi says, it's a bunch of Amoraim sitting around talking about their difficulty concentrating during Shemona Esrei. So Shmuel says, you know what I do during Shemona Esrei? I won't read the whole thing. He says, you know what I do during Shemona Esrei? I count clouds. This is Shmuel, a pretty heavy-hitting Amora, superstar. He says, I can't concentrate during Shemona Esrei. I count clouds. Then Ruchia says a little earlier in that Gemara, I never concentrated once during tefillah in all my days. I never concentrated. Once I wanted to concentrate it, but I couldn't get out of my mind trying to think of the royal hierarchy in the Reish Galusa. And then Ruchia's son says, you know what I do during Shemona Esrei, Rav Bun Bar Chia? He says, I count the layers of stones in the wall while I daven. And then Rav Manaya said, I'm grateful to my head because it bows itself when I fall modem. Unbelievable. Unbelievable honesty. Interestingly, a colleague of mine pointed out, I showed him this Gemara when we were putting together this discussion guide. So he pointed out to me that two of the people in this Gemara, one is Rav Chia and Rav Chia's son. The same Rav Chia, there's a Gemara that says that Rav Chia's prayers for rain were so powerful that there had to be divine intercession to get him to stop because there was fear that the rain would never stop because of the power of his tefillah. And how do you reconcile that? The same Rav Chia and his son, who say, I never concentrated a word, still had such powerful prayer. Interesting thing to think about. But the reason I'm saying this is it's so important to manage our expectations. Our children will never respond to unrealistic expectations. They will never respond to us pressuring them and expecting more of them than we expect of ourselves. Yet, like Rav Chia, when we daven, we have to realize we're not just davening for ourselves and our connection to the divine, we're also davening in a way that we have to understand that the best predictor of how our children will daven one day is how we daven. Even when we think they're not looking. They know and they notice. They can't look into our hearts to see our kavana, which may not be great if you're anything like these Amoraim, okay? But to see at least that you're taking it seriously, to see how much you talk during davening, to see sort of like how do you handle this whole God thing? What's your spirituality like? I have this image in my head of my shul on Yom Kippur year before last. There were 2-3 generation pairs up front in my shul. One was a very prominent member of the shul, very wealthy person, who was standing during the psicha of Nisana Tokov that went into Kedusha, talking nonstop to his friend. His son was behind him talking nonstop to the next generation through Kedusha on Yom Kippur, and the grandchildren were. So you had 3 generations of talkers through Kedusha. Through Nisana Tokov and Kedusha. And it was amazing. I just wished I had a heter to have a videotape. I would have shown it to you tonight. Would have blacked out their faces, shut you, because right next to them was another 3 generations of people davening with such clear kavana and clear recognition of what they were asking for that it impacted the whole shul positively. You heard them crying and you saw all 3 generations really connecting in that way. And we have to realize that, you know, there was something very profound going on there. And it's what we know. You don't need a psychologist, you don't need research or anything to tell you that this stuff is, you know, when we daven, and even when our kids are very young, we are modeling the way our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren will probably daven. We have to remember that and we have to think that. And with that being said, we also have to manage our expectations by remembering this Gemara that says this is tough stuff. So we have to go easy. It's what the Gemara tells us over and over again. You have to find the balance between the left hand pushing away while the right hand brings closer. love and limits. It's the key to parenting, it's the key to teaching, it's the key to spirituality. So that's number one in terms of davening. Number two in terms of davening is so we have managing our expectations while at the same time though having expectations. In the research on spirituality, they find that if you don't have the expectations and you don't sort of push your kids to go through the motions, even if it doesn't seem genuine, it's much less likely they're going to follow through into adulthood. That's shown over and over again. So there's something about going through the motions and showing that we care about it that's important also. And I know I'm contradicting myself, but it's that balance of expecting and putting limits, right? Some of you ask questions. So I push my kid to go to mincha on a snow day, okay? When he usually goes to a mincha minyan, and his friends are hanging around, and they never go to a mincha minyan. And do I make him feel like an idiot by sticking out from his friends and pushing him to go to shul down the block? Do I push him to daven mincha on Shabbos when all of his friends are playing sports and he doesn't want to feel left out? These are questions. And again, I can't give you the answer. I just know that it makes sense to push because pushing the behavior matters and our expectations matter and getting kids to daven matters, but without making it into a power struggle. We have to look into our heart and into our motivation, into our children's response, and it's going to depend on, it's going to differ from child to child based on their temperament, to make sure that it's not becoming religious and about a power struggle. The second religion is about a power struggle, we're dead. We're finished. Because then it's not about connection to God, it's about connection to you or lack of connection to you. So that's the other point. And let me just read to you two things. Again, this is in your handouts, but I'll read it. There's no reason to find it. One is the Chosev Lublin on something. This is a truth that I'm sure we all know. Everybody connects to God differently. Everybody has their own unique toolbox of spiritual connectors, and our job is to find what our connectors are. For some, it's Chesed. For others, it might be Tefillah. For others, it might be music. For others, it might be through stillness and meditation. Here's what the Chosev said all that time ago. He said it's impossible to tell people what way they should take in terms of spiritual connection. For one way to serve God is through learning, another through prayer, another through fasting, and still another through eating. Everyone should carefully observe what way his heart draws him to and then choose his way with all his strength. Very modern sounding. That's exactly what the Avichai Project is finding, and it's what makes it so complicated. Because every soul is unique. Rav Nachman said it beautifully. He said, the job of every Jewish parent and every Jewish teacher and every Jewish leader is to find the unique nigun, the unique melody, the unique chord, the unique spark of their child. And then, once we find the unique tune, we have to nourish it and we have to feed that to them. And that's what brings out the symphony of connection. But it's never monotone. It's different from child. We all know it. The longer siblings live under the same roof, the more different they become. Even though common sense would say the more similar they should become. So that's the Chosev. And now I'm going to read to you from a secular source called Crashing Through the Woods. And here's what it says. It's from Parker Palmer. If we want to support each other's inner lives, we must remember a simple truth. The human soul does not want to be fixed. It wants simply to be seen and heard. If we want to see and hear a person's soul, there's another truth. We must remember, the soul is like a wild animal, tough, resilient, and yet shy. When we go crashing through the woods, shouting for it to come out so we can help it, the soul will stay in hiding. But if we're willing to sit quietly and wait for a while, the soul may show itself. Interesting paradox I'm talking about. On the one hand, you need expectations. On the one hand, you need clarity. On the one hand, you have to push your kid to daven. And on the other hand, you have to give space for that shy soul to come out. Shy soul to come out. And that's the art of parenting and the art of teaching is finding that balance. And it's going to differ from family to family and from child to child. Let me tell you a story, okay? And then I'm going to pull this together, hopefully, with a couple of other thoughts. Story, it's an interesting story. I have a good friend who's actually rabbi of a large shul in my general neighborhood. And one Sunday afternoon, we had him over for a barbecue. And his kids practically grew up at my house. They were always coming over. And they were great kids, but some were a little more rebellious than others. And we're sitting around the barbecue, and he tells me the following story that had happened to him earlier that day. He said his son, growing up, his oldest son, hated wearing tzitzis. And here's the rabbi's son. He despised, he was tactile sensitive. He despised tzitzis. It cut through him. It felt like, who knows what it felt like to him. It just drove him nuts. And they fought throughout his childhood about his wearing tzitzis. It became a huge battleground. And then he didn't know why the battle stopped. And it turned out the reason it stopped is he got a little older, and you know, kids vote with their feet when they get a little bit older. He dug a hole and got a tin box that he put in the front of their yard, hidden by some bushes, and every morning when he'd run out to the bus, he'd take his tzitzis off, put it in the box. When he came home, he'd put it back on. He outsmarted his parents. That went on for his whole high school career. They never knew it. But he never wore tzitzis. So what happens? The kid grows up, he gets married, continues probably not to wear tzitzis. And what had happened that morning is his four-year-old son, my friend's grandson, comes running home from Gan. And he's all excited. He says, Abba, Abba, they taught us how to make a bracha on tzitzis today. Take your tzitzis out. I want to make a bracha on your tzitzis. And it hit him. It hit the kid, now father, that he's playing for keeps. And he started to cry. And he runs to his study in his house, and he calls his father, and he says, Daddy, he says, Ab, I just got to tell you something. I will never, for as long as I live, go through another day without putting tzitzis on. Now, why am I telling this story? Because the take-home message of this story is ambiguous. On the one hand, you could say, my friend blew it by making it into a power struggle. On the other hand, if he had totally ignored tzitzis, would his son have cried when his son, when his son came home and wanted to make a bracha? I doubt it. So that balance is probably necessary. And from what I know, that young man is now wearing tzitzis. But how you find that balance, I don't have easy answers to. I just know the research shows is you need the balance. And you need to find, it's like being a chef when you're parenting for spirituality. A little bit of this ingredient, a little bit of that ingredient, recognizing that you have to have reasonable expectations. And for everybody in this room, it's going to be a little bit of a different tweak in terms of your Shabbos table and in terms of how you're going to handle things like davening and kavan and sitting next to you versus going to groups. And there it's common sense kinds of recommendations. It depends what's happening in the group. It depends what your kids' perceptions are. The main thing, though, is they need to be relating to our religion from a place of joy. If it's not from a place of joy, they're not going to be motivated. It's just not going to work. You know, we connect so much better when it's through the Ahava dimension, not the Yura dimension. There's a new field now called neurotheology. So there's a neurobiologist at University of Pennsylvania who takes pictures of people's brains and looks at what's happening neurologically in different parts of the brain, and then he looks at different connections, and he finds that there's two sets of neural circuitry, one for the Ahava dimension, and it's actually a whole set of neurologic circuitry when we connect through love. Anybody who primarily connects to God through that set of neurologic circuitry, religion's associated with all kinds of good stuff. Lower levels of depression, more health, better marriages, everything good. If you're connecting mainly through Yira, I don't want to do this because God's going to kill me, I'm going to burn in the fires of hell. If it's mainly a toxic religion, then religion is associated with really bad stuff. Okay? Especially in today's generation, and especially with our kids, because we're living in a generation of right-hand specialists, of the Mimikarevis, not the Smoldocha. Doesn't mean you don't have the Smoldocha, but you have to do the Smoldocha and the limit setting in a very gentle kind of way. Okay. Let me try to bring this to an end so we can get some discussion going with... First, I'll read you the Tolstoy short story, and then I'll tell you a concluding story, okay, about... Okay. Anybody hear the Tolstoy short story, the old grandfather and the grandson? Anybody know it? Okay. Listen to this. It's about modeling, and it's about the essence of what we're talking about. And it's making the point with overkill, but it's such a good story. I just wanted you to hear it and think about it. It's in your handouts also. It goes like this. The grandfather had become very old. His legs wouldn't go. His eyes didn't see. His ears didn't hear. He had no teeth, and when he ate, the food dripped from his mouth. The son and daughter-in-law stopped setting a place for him at the table and gave him supper in back of the stove. Once, they brought dinner down to him in a cup. The old man wanted to move the cup and dropped and broke it. Daughter-in-law began to grumble at the old man for spoiling everything in the house and breaking the cups, and said that she would now give him dinner in a dishpan. The old man only sighed and said nothing. Once, the husband and wife were staying at home, watching their small son playing on the floor with some wooden planks. He was building something. Father asked, "What is it that you're doing, Misha?" Misha said, "Dear father, I'm making a dishpan so that when you and dear mother become old, you may be fed from this dishpan." The husband and wife looked at one another and began to weep. They became ashamed of so offending the old man, and from then on, seated him at the table and waited on him. Powerful, powerful story. And contrast that to the well-known description by Rav Soloveitchik of his mother and his connection to his mother that he said at the Hesped for the Rebbetzin of Talma. Anybody here not know, anybody here, everybody, I imagine it's a very commonly shared Hesped. How many people know the Hesped of the Rebbetzin of Talma the way the Rav Soloveitchik described his mother? And how many don't know it? Okay, so is it okay if I read it? It's just a minute. Is it okay? Do I have your permission to read it? Okay, I'm sorry, even though it's, okay. We're good? Okay. Because it's showing the opposite. And I want to connect through your Ava, not your Yura dimension. Tolstoy is Yura, the Rav Soloveitchik was Ava. I used to have long conversations with my mother. In fact, it was a monologue rather than a dialogue. She talked and I happened to overhear. She talked me in Yonah Diyoma. I used to watch her arranging the house in honor of a holiday. I used to see her recite prayers. I used to watch her recite the Seder every Friday night. Most of all, I learned that Judaism expressed itself not only in formal compliance with the law, but also in a living experience. She taught me that there's a flavor, a scent, and warmth to mitzvot. I learned from her the most important thing in life: to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hands resting upon my frail shoulders. Without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. That's the essence of what I'm talking about. And I'm talking about the invisible spiritual lessons we communicate to our kids through our expectations, through our modeling, through our davening, and everything else follows once we get that clear in our head. You ask in one of your questions, what do we do about our kids running out and playing basketball on a Shabbos afternoon? What do we do about them wanting to get out of their Shabbos clothing? You have to decide. And you have to figure it out. And you have to decide how important are each of you. I'm not talking about halacha. I have no right to talk to you about halacha. You have to decide what's your vision of Shabbos. What's your vision of what a Shabbos afternoon should look like? What's your vision of what the Ruach of Shabbos should be about, and then implement it. Again, I can't choose your values for you, but I just know that it's a worthy conversation and worth thinking about, and even if it means that your child may then stick out from peers, it may be worthwhile. And the final point I want to make, and then we'll get a discussion going to make this more real, is the point made a lot, and we've been learning this as we've been trying to implement spiritual education in the six high schools we're working with through the Avichai project, is that it's complicated, this stuff. It's not simple, but it's almost all done through the right hemisphere. It's done through stories, getting kids to connect to tefillah, and knowing that spirituality is not just about davening, it's about much more than davening, and trying to maybe talk about the things that spirituality are all about to our kids. So if a third of tefillah is gratitude, what are we grateful for? If davening or spiritual connection means something to us, self-disclose a little to your kids about some of these things so it could become more meaningful to them. Self-disclosure really does connect kids. And I'm going to end with a story that helped me with one aspect of my davening. I have about 20 stories like this, but I like this story, and I think it's as good a way as any to end. And then we'll get discussion going. I was invited to a Satmar weekend for children who were severely impaired, severely developmentally disabled. really severely. I mean, like, you know, kids who were at the severe end of special needs spectrum. I, in the worst way, did not want to go. The last way I wanted to spend my Shabbos with my wife was to leave the rest of my family and to spend Shabbos with a bunch of Satmar Hasidim. Okay? But they were persistent, and they did not let go, and they pushed and pushed and pushed. It was about a 5-year process. They finally wore me down. And I decided to go. This is last year. And I finally go to the Shabbaton. Of course, it was the high point of my year. They're very nice to me. The way they viewed me was different. One of them referred to me as being from Hasidei Umos HaOlam. You know, they viewed me as a righteous Gentile, but that was okay, you know? But it was an unbelievable Shabbos. And Friday night, there was a tish. And I went to the tish, and I was doing my thing with them. And we were just connecting. It's 1 o'clock in the morning, and one of the young fathers says, "Do you mind if I talk to you a little bit?" And he and his wife go with me to a corner of the lobby of the hotel. And he tells me the following story. He says, "I have an 8-year-old son. When he was born, we were told he is severely mentally retarded, severe communication loss. He will never walk. He will never talk. He'll never understand a word you say. He'll never sit up. He'll never sit up." So I wanted to hear the rest of the story. I'm not sure why he was telling me. It turns out he was just sharing with me. He said, he heard that there was a physical therapy program in Europe for these kinds of kids that maybe would give this boy a shot of learning how to sit up. He figured, you know, if you could sit up, you could see the world differently. Your eyes meet other people's eyes. Kamayim panam al panam kein leifa adam. We have mirror neurons. I go like this, there's a neuron in my motor cortex firing. Just a specific neuron for that. But the new research is showing over the last 5 years is as you see me go like this, each of you has a motor neuron that's firing like this. And it's the basis of empathy. But it only happens, it doesn't happen through texting. It happens through face-to-face communication. By the way, the enemy of spirituality is nonstop texting. I don't know if you want me to talk about half Shabbos. If you'd like me to, I'd love to. The tremendous growth of modern Orthodox kids texting on Shabbos. Well, I know your kids are not up to it. Hopefully, we'll never be up to it. But if you want, we could talk a little bit about it. But it's about the man realized it's my child's life. The quality of his life will change if he gets it up. He says he goes to Europe, and they start doing the therapy on him, and the kid's making some progress. He's not quite sitting up, but he's making progress. And he ran out of money. He had to go back to his job here in Williamsburg. And he runs out of money, and he begs them, "Teach me how to do the physical therapy myself. I just can't come back to Europe. I can't give up my family, the rest of my family." And again, he's persistent, as I learned they could be. And he pushes, 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 and finally they relent, and they teach him how to do it. And he goes home, and he works on his son for years. For years. And then he says, "Doc, mind if I show you something?" And I said, "No, of course." And he says, I want you to meet my son. I want you to see how this turned out." And he calls to a counselor at the other end of the hotel. And the counselor wheels in a wheelchair this severely impaired 8-year-old. You could just see this is not a functioning human being, but sitting up. And as the 8-year-old boy is wheeled to his mother, father, and to me, he flashes all three of us a $1 million smile. And all three of us are crying. Tears are like, it's tears of joy at the simple smile. And I was thinking about that. We take so much for granted in life. Here's a father and a mother who have been transformed by the miracle of their son sitting up. Since then, when I say Zokef Kfufim every morning, when I thank God for us standing upright or sitting upright, I see it in a different way. I find, and there are many, many stories like this, I find when I ask kids to share these stories, I mean, kids have stories like this. It could be something as simple as losing your luggage on vacation and knowing what it's like not to have your clothing and then getting it back and your gratitude for it. But there's so many times during our life that we can learn how to help our kids understand how to cue into Hakaras HaTov. And the same with every other aspect of spiritual connection, including stillness, including preparing them for the fact that it's okay to have a 24-hour period every week, a 25-hour period every week, where our cell phones are off and we're not talking to friends and we're not texting friends. And those lessons for ourselves where we shut our phones off. So I threw a lot at you, but basically, just to summarize what I've said, we talked about an answer to your questions. I didn't go through every one. These rather redundant answers are put down in this discussion guide. It's only a first draft. We're going to hopefully fix it up to make it more responsive to the discussion we'll have now and put it on the Institute website at YU. That you'll be able to access with an article we wrote on this based on what we heard from the Avichai project. That'll go into more detail about it. But again, the bottom line is this. Be clear about your goals. Listen to your children. Give them space. Give them a voice. And remember above all else how to model. Remember above all else that it's the invisible lessons that really lead to connection with God. And the way we model those invisible lessons are ultimately what spiritual education is all about. But now make it real for me. Throw questions or thoughts about it. I'm happy to entertain anything and make up an answer. Okay? Yes?
Some of the less obvious stressors or turnoffs for...
Yeah. Yes, so let me tell you what we learned from the kids who are a little bit older, but I think it's younger kids, it's a little bit less obvious, but I think it's just variations on the theme. Kids are pressure, time pressure, grading. They say that when tefillah is graded, it's a huge turnoff. When they feel pressure from parents to daven or to wear tzitzis or to wear a yarmulke, huge turnoff. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, like the story. That's why I told you that story. But that pressure, like that crashing in the woods quote, is poison for them. Judgmentalism kills them. They hate it when we get judgmental, either about their being too from or not from enough. They also very much are looking, especially when they get a little bit older, for a space where they could have what are the high school kids call DMCs. DMCs are deep, meaningful conversations. One of the high schools that we did our interviews in, the girls said that they had a free period throughout high school. Nobody in the school even knew this. You know how they used the free period? A group of girls got together and engaged in DMCs. They said it was their favorite class throughout high school, and they learned the most. No teachers there, just a place where they could sit and explore and think about the larger questions in life. That's what older kids do for a living. They you know, that's what adolescence is about. And you don't have to be high to do it. If you just have to nourish an atmosphere where people listen to you in a non-judgmental way. They hate apologetics. Nothing turns a kid off more than apologetics about great rabbis or about figures in Tanakh. They want honesty. And when you show flaws, that's why I chose to share that Yerushalmi with you. When you show flaws, it's a spiritual connector. I've shared with some of you when I talked in this neighborhood before the neurosurgeon study, one of my favorite studies of all time, right? They look at the top 1% of neurosurgeons and the bottom 1% of neurosurgeons to see what differentiates the neurosurgeons who are so good that they lose fewer patients than any neurosurgeon in the whole country. And how do they differ, in essence, from the bottom 1% who are so bad they get fired from their hospital positions? And it turns out it's not what you'd expect. It's not manual dexterity, it's not the medical school you went to, the surgery residency or fellowship that you went through. It has nothing to do with training. It has nothing to do with IQ, it has nothing to do with MCAT scores. It's all about how you handle your mistakes. To the extent that the top 1%, if they lost the patient, they would not rest till they figured out what went wrong. They'd go to the library, read everything they could find, go to the animal lab, do the surgery over and over and over again on those poor animals. They'd call the big experts around the world. They would not go home until they figured out how to change the setback to feedback and the threat to challenge. That's the difference. The bottom 1% would blame the nurses, blame the lighting in the operating room. It was never about them. There's something very connecting about modeling fallibility for our children, and it's spiritually connecting when the fallibility is in our rabbis and leaders and our in figures in Tanakh. It's an interesting, that's what we heard over and over again. That's true at least the modern Orthodox population. I don't know if it's true everywhere else. I spoke to a group of rabbis from across the spectrum today on a different topic, but somehow the topic of spirituality came up, and a person who was in charge of trying to nourish spirituality in reform Jewish adolescents told me it's pretty much what we were finding in the Avichai Project was exactly what was found in the work being done in the reform movement with their kids. Pretty universal. Lack of stillness, lack of connection, lack of room for deep and meaningful conversations. Pressure, academic pressure, kills kids' souls. And they say they can't unless they have, and when they connect, it's through nature, it's through informal education, it's through just giving their soul space to breathe. I know I'm sounding very spiritual and new agey here, but it's just, it's what the kids tell us. Maybe these kids are sounding that way. Now, your kids are too young to be there yet, but what happens to the spiritually connected bar mitzvah boy, or the spiritually connected girl? Why did they start to get so alienated in high school? Part of it's just developmental. It's what adolescents do for a living. They question and they have to question. But there are ways of setting things up now that make it much less likely that they'll be in the 50% of kids who keep half Shabbos. Okay? What's half Shabbos about? It's about a total lack of appreciation. Everybody know what half Shabbos is? So half Shabbos is this new thing, and I was debating whether or not to tell you, Rabbi Hagler said, tell it to them like it is, even though it's not something that's a problem here, certainly, and it's not an issue that we find until pretty much until high school, but it's pretty universal in modern Orthodox high schools. I hear this from virtually every educator anywhere in the country and beyond. Canada, I hear it in different parts of the world when I travel. What half Shabbos is about is that somewhere between, and I can't swear to it, but it's what the heads of school tell me and teachers tell me, somewhere between 40 and 60% of yeshiva high school kids in modern Orthodox high schools, even single sex, doesn't mean that you're protected if they go to single sex versus co-ed, but that they keep Shabbos in front of their parents, they keep Shabbos in public, but the pull to connect to their friends is so great. To them, to not text on Shabbos is as difficult as not speaking on Shabbos. The most important thing for an adolescent is to feel like they fit in. And therefore, they go into their rooms on Shabbos, and they know that all their friends are texting, and they can't withstand the temptation, and they text as well. And the percentages I hear over and over again is at least 40%. Now, I don't know if that's true everywhere. We certainly don't have good empirical evidence on it. But it's something that I hear so much, including one camp that I spent the Shabbos at, where the kids, after they were opening up to me and really talking to me, they said, you know, we have two phones. There's a phone we give in before Shabbos, because that's camp rules. So it's our Shabbos phone. We give it to the head counselor before Shabbos, and then we have our Shabbos phone. What's the Shabbos phone? It's the phone that they text with on Shabbos. Okay? That's when the kids started to really open up, and they knew I was from away, you know, they knew that I was safe. And when kids really open up, that's what they start to tell you about. What's that about? It's about something I think we might be able to prevent. We have to model proper use of technology. We have to also help them understand that what they're doing is they're throwing away something that's beautiful and necessary. Now's not the time to do it when your kids are very young, but maybe in eighth grade it's time to start having conversations with kids about this. How to withstand pressure and how to be out of it and how it's fine to be out of it. And the way, when I talk to kids to do this, they tell me what happened. Shabbos, they're not texting on Shabbos. Shabbos is over, they pick up their phone and they see that there have been maybe 100 texts going back and forth between all their friends that they missed out on. That's a very hard thing for an adolescent to withstand. And then it's like dominoes. So the less observant kids start doing it, and throughout the course of high school, it dominoes one by one by one. It goes from the co-ed schools to the single-sex schools, and it goes down that way. I'm not saying it to frighten you. I'm just saying it that it's oh, by the way, and the good news is we also did research on 600 kids in Israel. The vast majority of them, from everything I could tell, come back after the year in Israel, and they certainly come back after they go to YU. but they do come back. So this isn't a permanent thing, but it says something about spirituality. But anyway, I hope that was a very long-winded answer to your question. Yes. Yes, so let's talk about that question. The question, which is an excellent question, what do I think, and again, it's opinion, not fact, about cordoning kids off at kids' tables on a Shabbos lunch. And this is a bias, I really believe it's fine to have a kid's table as long as it's after you have them with the adults. I think that the default setting should be we spend so little time with our kids during the week very often. And maybe if that's not the case, and maybe if that's not the need, that's differently. But the research shows the more times a week that we have meals together with our kids, the better the chance is that they're going to internalize our values. Shabbos is really the time to connect that. And what could be more important than that? So, you know, kids are going to lose patience anyway. At least have the first chunk of the meal together with them and talking to them and including them in our conversations. It shapes their values. Do it. And then later on, maybe you could have them run off and have fun and maybe set up a kid's table for a dessert or for later on. But in terms of the core meal, my recommendation would be err on the side of having them there. And limit your inappropriate conversations till after you think they've really left, okay? And then you can talk about the principal and the teachers and the rabbi and all of that and say all the wonderful things you will about them. But remember, that's really shaping them. It really does shape their attitudes. And to expose them to high-level conversations and ask them their opinion is actually a great way of sharpening their thinking and of transmitting our values to them. Why lose that? It's a wonderful way. YU now has a wonderful series coming out of the Center for the Jewish Future on Shabbos lunch discussion guides. It's discussion guides that are great. They're great teachable moments you could get online by going onto that website. And really, it's wonderful. It's, you know, it talks about all kinds of, ethical dilemmas that come up in life, and then it brings Jewish thinking into it. Kids love it when you get them talking about it. It's just sort of fun, and you can get really good discussions going that maybe the adults around your table will enjoy also. And then there's plenty of time to schmooze with them until you invoke the Schimmel rule. Okay? Okay. So, yeah. Yes?
I want you to just a little bit more to expound on sort of the peer pressure issue. We're very careful about Shabbos clothes, for example. My son went away and saw all the kids change and said, came home and said, I can't believe they all changed on Shabbos. So what should the response be?
Yeah, thanks so much for saying that, because that I didn't talk about that enough. So just to repeat the question, and it's a very real question. Let's say your kid has 7 friends. They all change into play clothing on Shabbos afternoon, and they come to your house for lunch with the bag, the famous bag. And their running shoes and all of that, and your kid is the nerd with looking like an Oreo, the white shirt and the black jacket or whatever it might be. And how could you do that to the poor kid? And will they one day become a druid in rebellion against you? That's the question. Excellent question. What I would do is, for the first most important thing is validate away. Allow them to be angry at you. Now, so if you decide this is important to me, that's fine. If you decide it's important and you decide, look, you know, I know this is hard, I know it's difficult, but it's very important to me. And you're allowed to be upset by it. You know, the Hebrew word ashrei, which is the highest level of happiness, is tied to the word yishur, to validate. When you validate somebody and they feel heard, they're much more likely to internalize our values. I think, look, it depends on degree. But by the way, many of them, what I find is they'll go underground. So when they go to their friends' houses, they'll find a way to change into their friends' clothing. And you're not going to be able to completely control it. But remember, rules without relationships equals rebellion. The key is to work on your relationship, hear them, understand you won't be able to completely control it, but just making your position clear and letting them know that it's okay to be upset. You don't have to like it, you just have to do it. And then if they don't do it, you have to, I deal with it in a soft way. But it should be a consistent message. So I think that's what, you know, and by the way, and they'll do it. It's a very common question I get with rabbis' children. I get this question, this is, I call this the Chabad question. When I sometimes I'll be asked to speak at a shluchim conference. You know, they have 2,000 or 3,000 shluchim come here every year. And sometimes I'll be asked to speak there. And it's a very common question, because they're, you know, it's, you could imagine if you're living in the middle of nowhere in Europe or Asia or in different parts of the United States, and you're the only kid dressed a certain way and everybody else is dressed, and it's really hard for them. But you know what? They keep their eye on the ball, and if you want to raise your children to be little future shulchan, that's what you do, you know. And that, not, it doesn't always work, but there's clarity there. There's clarity, and it works, and it works with us also, there's clarity. But obviously you have to have seichel. Sometimes if it's really, really, if you have a kid who has a temperament, that it's really, really destroying them, then you have to either have a friendectomy by considering a different group of friends, which is probably not in your control, or you have to maybe relent. Maybe it's not a worthy battleground. You have to always figure out, is this a worthy battleground? Because it's certainly, you could win the battle and lose the war. I'm putting out these little cliches. I'm sorry, but I'm going to sound like a psychologist as I get older. Okay? Yes, other questions, thoughts? Yes. Yeah, it's a very good question. The research shows that that table talk in most homes usually goes to the level of the oldest child. But because of that, younger children are usually pulled into it in a way that helps them, and they become more sophisticated, maybe also a little bit more jaded. So you do your best to you do your best to try to fit each of them. No two kids are the same anyway, and recognize that it's not, you're not going to be able to tailor it in a way that's perfect for everybody. But you try to find a way to steal time for each of the kids to have at least a little bit of individual one-on-one time. And that's ideal. But it's still, obviously, you know, a toddler, you're not going to be able to have the same level of discussion that you have with your 10-year-old. And that's fine. And that's the nature of families. I just told somebody before about a friend that has how many kids? 12 kids, you know. And somehow families manage to thrive even in those situations in spite of the tremendous variation. But yeah, that's an important point. But I don't have any magic. Anybody here have magic for that? Or yeah. Okay. Yes.
So we try our best as parents to love, set limits, have realistic expectations, and then maybe we make, you know, just the example of clothes, maybe the wrong expectations or not appropriate expectations for that child. So we validate and maybe reassess our expectations, like you said. How do we do that? And at the same time, I have teenagers, my youngest is 12, so just to give you where I'm coming from. How do you change your expectations for them and give them the message still that... it doesn't always happen that way, because like I'll get a response to a conversation and they're like, well, you're not listening to me, you're not taking my feelings into account, and I'm like, I am. They're like, you're not, because you're not doing what I say. And you know, sometimes you can and sometimes you can't.
Give me more specifics about how does that play out then. So what do you, so you have a 12-year-old, and then, so what are the different ages?
12, 14, 16, 19.
Okay, so 12-year-old's the youngest. And then what happens? So what?
I can't think of something.
No, but just in a general way. In a general way.
Like if we were, it's not the clothes, but let's say it was the clothes. So let's say we would reassess and say, okay, well, you can wear sneakers on Shabbos, and as long as you're wearing a white polo shirt and dark pants,
right,
that's okay. Compromise, which you know, right, you know, happens to say, but it's great. Well, okay, so the next time something comes up, they tell you, you validate them, you assess your expectations and decide that, like you said, it's, it's that important that you're not compromising. You're validating and everything else you say, and the child's response is, but I told you how I feel. You're not taking my feelings.
Right. I hear. Okay, I hear. And the only answer I have for that is to say that's fine. Now, there's a difference between validating and agreeing. Okay, it's true in life, and they don't have to like it. In other words, and that's fine. So you validate, and so they don't like it. I mean, that's part of parenting. Is sometimes, you know, there's a medrash in Mishlei. By the way, I was just thinking, Rabbi Keller is coming in a couple of weeks. I don't know, I think to speak here. Thinking that, you know, you want to talk to somebody. He has 18 children and a lot of experience with child rearing and educating. He's the guy to ask these questions. So your question goes to Rabbi Keller. In 2 weeks, that's the question for him. But anyway, because I only have 4 kids. A father of 18, he'll know. Make sure to ask him that question. Let me give you a medrash. Maybe it'll help a little bit, although it probably won't. But I'll give it anyway. There's the pasuk in Mishlei that says Yaser Bichokei Shikva Vel Hamisol Titein Avshech, which means put limits on your kids. There's always hope. Don't pay attention to their crying. So the medrash says the following. It says Kol Hamosif Av Yisurim Al Beno Mosif HaBen Ahava Al Aviv. Very weird medrash. It says, the more you put limits on your kids, the more your kid will love you. Not in the short term, it's in the long term. A phenomenon I see over and over again, kids come back from Israel, and I'm not talking about kids who flip. The flipping is becoming less and less, actually. I don't know if you've known that lately we call discontinuous religious change is becoming more and more of a rarity. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but it happens much lower percentages than it used to. But kids will come back from Israel, and they'll be angry at their parents, saying, why was it that you didn't put limits on me when I was in high school? Why did you let me do this? Why did you let me do that? It's a very interesting phenomenon. So you have to look at it with that wider lens sometimes. So they may not be happy now, and that's fine. You could be a good parent and a loving parent and even be loved by your child, even though they're temporarily going to want to kill you. That's fine. That's part of the nature of being 12. And it doesn't mean they don't love you. You know the name of that best-selling book about adolescence, Mom, Would You Get Out of My Life, But First Would You Take Me and Cheryl to the Mall? You know, so that's the way to think about it. Yeah.
Second child, I kind of know what's realistic for my third, you know, but for the first one, I always have that trouble. Every time they get older, I don't know what's realistic. Maybe I'm too hard, maybe I'm too soft.
Yes, I mean, look, it's a good question. What's the saying? We always tend to spoil or ruin our first pancake. Yeah. Our bechor is usually the carbon, right? But I think all you could do is, you know, ask. Find friends. If you have friends, if he or she has classmates who are the younger in the family, get the wisdom of their parents. Talk to educators. Nobody knows children better than educators, right? So if you have a fifth grade teacher knows more about that age group in this community than anybody does. Ask Rabbi Hagler. Ask people who have a lot of experience. And that's that, because it's hard. It's a complicated world now. And it's hard to know what's normal in the statistical sense and what's to be expected and what's abnormal. The people who know, this man knows. He really knows, and deep in his kishkas, because he lives it. And every teacher in this school knows, because they live it. And parents who are, you know, who your kids may be friendly with, who are on their third, fourth, fifth kid or beyond, will know. And that's usually, that wisdom will probably help a lot. Because otherwise, you're right, that's a good question. Yes?
What happens if, like, what do you have two children who might be close in age, and the expectations, they might not be able to live up to the same expectations because they're different. And yet you're setting limits and trying to, you know, inspire their spirituality and figure out how to set rules and what have you for each of them, but that they might be different. Yet they're close in age, so they're looking at each other, and you get into this problem, well, if he can do it, why can't I do it? But one child may not be able to handle what another can, and vice versa. So
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I can add, and that's always a tough question, and I'm going to give you a psychologist's answer, okay? And that's that we all know that you don't treat kids equally, you treat them according to their own unique needs. That's a truism, and it's really true. Now, that'll mean that, so let's say the child close in age is really going to resent it, because you're letting him get away with this, and it's not fair, and you love him more, or whatever it'll be. And I know it's not enough to validate it, but you know what I find is this often, if you take that kid who's so upset, and not in the heat of the moment, you strike when the iron is cold, you have a calm, planned discussion with the child, say, look, I understand why it's so frustrating, but, you know, there are different rules because, you know, I love you all the same, but I love you all differently because you're different, and I to explain a little bit why the needs of one is different than the needs of the other in some way. And when you do that in a calm time, and then if they're still really upset, maybe it means that they need a little bit extra feeding, and you find out how to nourish them to go back to Rav Nachman. So how do you nourish their unique nigun? But the key is, again, a combination of planned discussion, strike when the iron is cold, and to be understood for us to understand. All of those cliches, I think, is the way to go with it. Okay, does that kind of make sense? And it's still not going to be very satisfying, but I don't know any other way of doing it. Yeah. Yeah.
In terms of clarity and setting goals, at what age do you think it's meaningful to the kids that they actually get what you're saying? And I know you can always speak on different levels to different children, but where is it actually impactful?
Yes, that's a good point. When I said clarity of goals, I don't mean necessarily goals that you transmit to the children in some theoretical way. Obviously, kids are not going to really be able to understand it in an abstract way till they're probably hitting on, you know, 10, 11, 12. And obviously, you could communicate some very clear expectations even to a 3- and 4-year-old, to a toddler. You know, you could communicate clear expectations. So the more abstract goals have to wait, I think, until they're older. And even then, you know, you probably have to wait until they're middle school age in order for them to hit the ability to think about and understand the abstract goals. I think what I was really talking about was more of an internal process as husband and wife, or as a couple, or as a parent, to be able to really look into your own soul, so to speak, to find out what are the goals that you have. I don't even know that it needs to be communicated, except maybe in whatever set of rules are really important. But the real thing is what's important to you? What's your ideal Shabbos table look like? And then to see, can you share that vision and dream with your wife, you know? Or, you know, if you're a single parent family, then are you able to communicate that in a way that makes the most sense? But then to share in that vision and dream and to be clear about it and then to try to implement it, it's implemented for the child and not at an abstract level, but at the level of whatever expectations. And then if they know when something's important to you, they know what you emphasize, you know, and does that kind of answer it? Or I'm missing something.
Maybe I need to rephrase.
Yeah, rephrase, yeah.
I guess maybe more in the communication with the child and getting their feedback in terms of, let's say, the Shabbos table experience, what they're looking to get out of it. At what age are they actually thinking about these things? If I talk to my 4-year-old about what she wants, you know, it's going to be much, but it's not what we're trying to actually get at. So at what age do they really try it?
So it probably depends on the kid, and my guess is it's going to be considerably older than 4, you know, before they can do it. But the only way to know is to talk it out and see what they get. You know, they might be surprised though at how, at a pretty young age, they might get some basics in terms of what you're trying to communicate. But I think that the younger they are, the more it's the aroma. That's why it was worth reading that eulogy of the Talmud Rebbetzin. Sort of it's the scent, it's the aroma. And frankly, that's what really matters. It's the atmosphere. It's Shabbos table really, it's this miros, it's if you do it. It's the scent. You know, it's the sense of being relaxed. It's, you know, it's all that kind of stuff. And that's transmitted through the nonverbal. Yeah.
I'm assuming that my kid's the only one who does this. But,
yes.
Whether it's benching or davening, he will claim to have benched or claim to have davened, where it literally would be physically impossible for a human being to say anything so quickly. So, my wife, who's much more sensitive to these issues than I am, says, at least he pretended to go through the motions, leave him alone, eventually he'll do it. On the other hand, I say to my wife, well, he thinks he pulled the rug over our and he thinks he'll keep doing it because we keep saying, oh, it's okay, no problem. So where's the balance there? Do I say, say Shema like a bench and take the time, or do I say, good job?
Let me ask you, let's say you had him say Shema like a bench, would he do it? If you did it in a really calm way, so you're bouncing back at him, love and understanding and compassion, okay? Would he do it?
I have no idea.
So experiment with it. But if what he's bouncing back to you is annoyance, then your wife is right. Remember Ruchia, remember Shmuel. They were counting clouds and counting layers of stones. I think that, so if he's faking it, he's faking it, but at least he's faking it. Better for him to fake it. That's what... what are the three predictors of kids who make it into young adulthood still being connected spiritually and religiously, okay? Three predictors are the following. It's what their parents did, if their parents were modeling for them when they were kids. The second predictor is how important is religious action and beliefs in the mattering map of the child as transmitted by the parent. Faking benching is part of that salience. And the third is action. As he gets a little bit older, you may want to, maybe you need to be singing more benching. Maybe you need to have a fun part of benching that's more, that brings some more joy into it. There's a strong halachic literature that talks about quality over quantity. And if you could get some quality going in something that maybe might be meaningful to him, maybe a story will be something he'll connect to. Maybe there'll be one thought that he'll connect to. Maybe it'll be a bakasha part of some part of davening because of a relative that he's worried about. And if you could get him to connect in just one area, that then might become at least meaningful there, and let him fake the rest. Call him every once in a while, but gently. Call very gently, okay? Yeah, good question. Yes. By the way, people could truly feel, and you're next. People could truly feel okay about leaving, including my nieces and nephews in the corner there. You could go, you're not in trouble if you leave, okay? And it's totally fine. I'm not going to take your names down. Yes. Right.
If you have a child who is not receptive to some of the things you're talking about, but your other kids may or may not be, is there sort of a strategy of, do you leave one... say you're not interested, go read your book on the living room couch. The others will, just by virtue of age or personality or otherwise, sort of tend to follow. But how do you, if you have an outlier, any suggestions as to how to bring the others?
Yeah, so good question. So one is if you have an outlier who really, there's no chance that person's going to be able to do to sit without huge battles, then I would have a private discussion with all of them at some point. Not then. Again, strike when the iron is cold, plan discussion later, where you say, look, I know, that Joey is a pain in the... No, I wouldn't say it that way. You say, that Joey, really, it's harder for him. And I'm going to look the other way with him, because there are other things I expect him to do that I don't expect you to do. But I know you're able to do it. I'm really proud of you when you sit at the table. So even though you're going to be tempted to go after him, it means a lot to me, and I really expect you to sit for a certain amount of time, and then hear what they have to say, okay? And let them be angry, and let them but make it clear and appeal to the stronger part of them, and then come up with some kind of compromise position that everybody could live with. But again, when you're proactive that way, and you think about it ahead of time, and you're ahead of the curve, you probably will be able to get somewhere with that. Okay? I hope. Try it. I'm from out of town. You won't even know. Okay. Yes. Thank you for being so. Okay. So this will be the last question. You've been very patient. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. So the question is about groups, and that was a little bit in the guide, and I don't have any great answers for it, other than to say it depends on the group, it depends on the kid, because it's really true. You know, if a kid loves going to group, and the group has some good content to it, then wonderful. Should there be at least part of tefillah that your kid is sitting next to you? I think that's ideal. But only when they're old enough to appreciate it a little bit. So even if it's just sitting next to you for, if it's a father and son sitting next to each other for Birchos Kriya Shema maybe, or for Hazaras Tishat. So, you know, you have certain things that you decide are meaningful, and you can maybe even have discussions about. So you have that, but it should be err on the side of short, err on the side of making of doing it only if he or she's not feeling left out then. You know, it can't be. The main thing here is you don't want religion ever to be a battleground. You just don't want it, because then you've lost. By the way, this way of thinking, you could go to the Haredi world. Any gifted Haredi educator will tell parents this about their Hasidic kids with long payas. Don't battle over tefillah until the kid's at least 10, 11 years old. I know that because I'm friendly with some of these guys, and they all say the same thing. This is not a where we are in the dimension of orthodoxy or whatever. Okay, so you just keep that in mind, and it should mostly be about joy. That's we will have done our job if our kids are connecting to the ahava and joy dimension of spirituality and religion, and in a way that it's something that then will automatically bring out their spark. So thank you, everybody.
I want to again thank Dr. Pelkowitz very, very much for being here on this late hour. Thank you to everybody that worked on this program. There are refreshments, and we are going to daven Maariv in 5 minutes in the room right next door.
Anybody want to daven Maariv, or are you going to? All the men have to go. They have to have Havana, and none of the women can go.
There'll be a little test on the number of bricks in the wall after.
Thank you.